Welcome to Crossing the Divide, the official podcast, a grassroots, multimedia exploration of the intricacy of life in the Intermountain West. Crossing the Divide elevates local voices to educate the community on regional matters and fosters cooperative engagement in overcoming the unique challenges of life west of the Continental Divide. Not New York, not LA. Crossing the Divide is a unique tribute to life in the continental in-between. Support for Crossing the Divide comes from Rocky Mountain PBS, Mesa County Libraries, and the Daily Sentinel. I'm Gretchen Reist, your guide over the divide and into the diverse terrain of Western Colorado. In this edition of Crossing the Divide's official podcast, I'll be talking with Jackie Sievers, director of the Latimer House, serving victims of domestic abuse and sexual assault over a four-county region. Administered by Hilltop Community Resources, it provides a 24-hour crisis line, emergency shelter, counseling, legal, and relocation services, moving clients from crisis to confidence. Jackie, welcome to Crossing the Divide, and thank you for taking time out of your very busy schedule to speak with me about the critical services provided by Hilltop's Latimer House here in Grand Junction.
Thank you for having me.
Why don't you tell us about your specific role at the Latimer House?
So I'm the program director, so I oversee operations, funding, and outreach, all of the big picture elements of the program.
And how did you come to be involved with the Latimer House?
Well, Latimer House is one of the programs from Hilltop Community Resources. I've been with Hilltop for 20 years and moved to Latimer House in 2005. And have done a variety of things, but keep returning to that program.
Jackie, what can you tell us about the history of the Latimer House program?
Latimer House was started as a grassroots effort here in Grand Junction by a group who wanted to make sure there were crisis response services for women who had been abused. It started as a crisis line and then grew into some support services and eventually a safe house. It operated as an independent nonprofit, but this business is very hard to sustain, and so eventually it merged with the Resource Center nonprofit and ultimately Hilltop.
Does the Latimer House exclusively serve women, or are you also providing services to men who might find themselves in domestic violence situations?
At Latimer House, we serve all genders, and that includes our Safe House program. So it is one of the myths about domestic violence that it's women only, and that's not accurate. So 1 in 3 women will experience interpersonal violence in a relationship in their lifetime, and 1 in 4 men will experience it.
Part of the impetus for my wanting to explore this particular topic was a UN report that came out, I believe, in November of last year. And the findings of that report were essentially that the most dangerous place for a woman, and this is something worldwide, this is a worldwide phenomenon, is in her own home. That came as a really big shock to me, because as a woman, I often think, I'm not going to jog at night. I'm not going to go up in the trails without a dog. Home is not the place that I would think of as being a danger.
Unfortunately, it's not a surprise for me. Both domestic abuse and sexual assault are most common from people that we know, people that we even love.
Another statistic that I had read recently was that homicide is now the second leading cause of death among pregnant women. I'm wondering if you can touch upon that a little bit.
Any factor that makes a person more vulnerable will exacerbate the likelihood that they'll be abused and the intensity of that abuse. So that might be a disability, it could be a mental health condition, could be pregnancy. So anything that creates more dependence, weakens a person's strength, resolve, really contributes to domestic abuse.
When we look at domestic violence in our community, how do rates of domestic violence here measure against statewide incidences of domestic abuse and incidences nationwide?
The rates here are comparable to other communities. It's challenging to get good rates because we know most domestic violence is not reported. Even what's reported does not often end up resulting in an arrest or a conviction. So we look at the filings from the DA's office. We do look at arrest rates and then our own service rates and compare that per capita.
What are some of the main reasons that even cases that are reported don't end in any type of conviction?
Domestic violence is often a family secret, and there are elements that happen that are very difficult to prove. And so for an arrest to occur, law enforcement officers have to have enough evidence to prove that a crime was committed. And people who use abusive tactics are good at not leaving evidence. So that becomes a real challenge for law enforcement officers as well as our DA's offices.
If we're going to use the umbrella term abuse, what types of abuse does that encompass?
Most people think of the physical abuse, and that's the easiest to see and to understand. There's also emotional abuse, which is anything that would be hurtful to the person. So that could be insults, it could be threats or harm to something or someone that the person cares about. Psychological abuse is often making the person feel crazy and really using manipulative tactics, gaslighting it's often called, bringing themselves into question. Financial abuse is very common. So the abusive party ends up with all the money in their name, property in their name, even medical insurance. So medical abuse can occur as well. So withholding insurance information, withholding the ability to seek medical care. So there's a whole array of types of abuse that are used by the person using the abuse to gain power and control over their partner.
Can you tell us approximately how many clients you serve on a yearly basis?
With our crisis line, we take a little over 1,200 calls per year. And we don't track if that's duplicated or not, but that's just the number of phone calls that come in. That line is available 24/7 for people who might want somebody just to talk to or might be seeking service. With our Safe House program, we serve between 200 and 250 people in that program in Mesa County each year. The average length that people stay with us is about 2 weeks. So some will be less, some will be more, depending on their circumstances. So we have both adults and kids that come into the Safe House. And then we serve about another 200 people per year that don't need the safe housing portion, but maybe want some support with safety planning or life skills or figuring out where to go next.
So while they're in for that 2 weeks, are you working to find them more permanent housing in that time?
The priority in Safe House is generally safety. So might be getting protection orders, figuring out what they need for safety. And then, yes, whatever's next for them. So that might be relocating, being closer to family, friends, might be getting their own place locally. So that is our priority when they're with us. We take a lot of precautions, as you would imagine, with our Safe House. And law enforcement here locally are great partners with us. So if we ever have concerns, they're a great support in maintaining safety. We haven't had a lot of issues in the past, which is great. And we recently relocated our Safe House, which helps it be a more confidential location as well.
When we look at demand for services here locally, how does that compare to our community's ability to provide those services?
It's critical for us that we can respond, especially to those in crisis. So we have a team that responds to that crisis line, and we use volunteers to help us man the crisis line 24/7. We are a very small team. We have three case managers here in Grand Junction. We have a couple of part-time staff that help, and then the program manager and myself. So I think the more people are aware, the more people reach out, the more support we're going to need. And whether that be with volunteerism or growing our team, I think we're getting close to the point of needing to grow.
In the years that you've been working for this organization, Have you seen an uptick in need for services? And if so, to what do you attribute that? Is it an increase in domestic violence, or that we've been able to some extent to lessen the stigma of people reaching out for help?
I see peaks and valleys in the demand for our services. They tend to be somewhat seasonal, and also really correlate to how much outreach we're doing. So thank you again for the work that you're doing. I do think there is a destigmatization in reaching out for help. And I think we see a broader array of people who come in for service, and people coming in before the violence has escalated. So we really want to connect with people before their lives are in danger. And I see more of that.
You mentioned a little bit earlier about working with local law enforcement. I can imagine with the variety of services you provide, it's probably difficult for one organization to be able to work alone in that. Can you talk a little bit about some of your interagency partnerships?
Our partnerships and collaborations are essential. Like you mentioned, we could not do this alone. So for the crisis response, the law enforcement, DA's office, also our probation department are critical in working with us. Each of those entities has a victim's advocate, and also law enforcement uses the VAPs, which are volunteers, responding to scenes, providing support to victims of crime. They're the ones that we often partner with to bring people into safe house and for those initial steps that they need to take. Many of the people we serve are going to need legal resources, so that might be protection orders, custody, they might be pursuing divorce. So Colorado Legal Services and Pro Bono Project are key legal partners for us, and they assist a lot of the people that we serve, and they prioritize serving people who've been impacted by domestic violence. And then a whole array of community-based services, so housing authority and different housing programs, Catholic Outreach and their programs, MindSprings and other mental health providers. So we really pull together a team to say, how can we best meet this person's needs and which of us can do what part?
How do things like the local economy play into the work that you do, both in terms of when things are economically bad and when things are going well economically, particularly with housing? I have to imagine that sometimes a financial dependence could be a reason why someone might be reluctant to leave a situation, because where are they going to find housing? And if you have people in your safe house who need to find their own place, but there's difficulty in finding affordable housing, I'm just curious how local economics play into everything that you do.
Finances are top of mind for people who are considering leaving. And you're right, the economy does play in. So when the economy's not good, that increases stress. And increased stressors in a home where abuse is used escalates that abuse. It also makes it challenging for the person to leave. So will they be able to sustain themselves and their children potentially? The housing market makes it a challenge. I mentioned that the average length of stay with us is 2 weeks. So trying to find housing that is affordable in that length of time is difficult. We're blessed to have some housing dollars. We can help people get started, and we partner with other housing organizations in the community. But it makes it hard, and often that's why people will relocate.
I would be curious to know how often, if at all, you get people into a safe house situation and they end up returning.
It's difficult to leave a domestic violence relationship. And, you know, the rates, when you look at it statistically, equal the rates of trying to get off of heroin. So 7 to 11 times people will often leave and then return, leave and return. And for some people, that's not true. Once, and they move on. And it's complex. I think sometimes we forget when we're talking about domestic violence that these are also real relationships. There's history, there's love, there's children, there's a shared life, shared home. And so it's not as easy as it may be in our minds when we're listening to someone's story to think, why don't you just walk away? You're walking away from all of that and into a very uncertain future. So when we think about success, it's really about the people we're serving meeting their goals and being able to live safe lives and whatever that looks like for them.
It would be interesting to know approximately or just in general of the people that you serve. Are many of them people who have experienced violence in some form farther in their past?
Yes, I think people who witness domestic violence as children are more likely to use abusive tactics themselves or be in abusive relationships. Domestic abuse is learned behavior and a way of getting their needs met. And so often people who are abusing grew up with that. And then we see it the other side as well.
You mentioned a little while back that you do serve children as well. If you can talk for a little bit about the effects of these violent situations on children, what you see.
The effects on children can be actually with brain development if the children are young enough. So we often think the children who will remember seeing the abuse might be most impacted. Actually, young children are most impacted because of that brain development. And it impacts the kids' ability to identify and understand emotions, to be able to constructively solve problems, their confidence. And kids who were exposed to domestic violence often have mental health conditions as they grow older. There is a statistical correlation there.
If there is someone listening out there who feels that they are in a situation that could become dangerous or is abusive in some way, could you take us through the process, the steps that they would go through to remove themselves from that situation and be able to move forward?
Yes. A great first step is calling the crisis line. And that might feel daunting, but it's really a place to talk and process. We often get the question, this happened, is that abuse? And so we can really help people understand what might be happening in their relationship, identify if there is a pattern of power and control, and then what the person might want to do about that. And again, a crisis line is 24/7, so it doesn't matter what time of day it is or when it might be safe to call. Then connecting with one of our staff, if you are considering leaving, doing a little planning around that is important. Leaving an abusive relationship is the most dangerous time. So getting some information about what's helpful, how to approach that safely is really important, and our staff can assist in doing that. Then there would be some preparation, getting important documents together, driver's license, birth certificate, social security card, those kinds of things, and having a thoughtful way out that protects your safety as much as possible. I would also remind people to use law enforcement if needed. So if you're starting to leave, you're taking those steps and you get scared, call 911. Law enforcement officers would want to assist you to get to safety, and they can help you get to us. If somebody needs safe house, they would meet with our staff. We would go through some of the inevitable paperwork, talk about what the experience will be like, and really we give people a few days just to get their feet under them, get to breathe a little bit, and then start working on what is it you need to be safe and what is it you want for your future and how can we help you get there. If you think you're in an abusive relationship and you don't want to leave, that's okay too. still reach out. We're happy to talk with you, to plan for safety, to listen, to validate, whatever it is that you need from us. So you don't have to be leaving the relationship to access our service.
And that's an important point, because you have to be ready. But knowing that there is still a support system for those initial phases of that, even if you're not going to leave tomorrow, is very important.
Absolutely.
Do you see people from all levels of life, all ages, coming in to access your services?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's one of the myths of domestic violence, that there's a certain population that it would impact. You know, as you might imagine, people who are younger or lower income or have some of the vulnerabilities we talked about are more likely to need more services. But absolutely, domestic violence crosses all bounds, and we have all types of people accessing us.
So we've talked about a lot of difficult things. This is very difficult subject matter, but we always want to leave people on a message of hope. I'm wondering if you can leave us with that positive message that I think we all need to hear, even if we're not in these situations. I often read the statistics and feel very overwhelmed. What would you leave us with?
The services that are in place work, whether it's for the person using abusive tactics or whether it's for the survivor. There is hope of living violence-free, of being happy, of having healthy, happy kids. We have an amazing array of service providers in our community, of professionals that really are very committed to helping people move forward. And we see that work. We have people come back who are living their best lives, and they initially came to us on their worst day.
If people are listening who want to be a part of helping victims of abuse not just survive, but thrive, you've mentioned that you use volunteers in a number of capacities. What would you advise to people out there thinking, I want to be a part of the solution to this problem?
I think there are a lot of ways to help. For people who want to do direct contributions, we do use volunteers on our crisis line. That's critical, and for some other services. So you can find our volunteer opportunities on our website at htop.org. As I mentioned, law enforcement also has their victims assistance programs, both the police department and sheriff's department. And there are ways to volunteer as well that aren't perhaps as time intensive or require as much commitment. So we need to do special events and fundraisers to help our program, and we always need people to assist with that. We have businesses and individuals who will sponsor events for us. So people might do a pajama drive or a school supply drive for us, and those are great ways to contribute to the effort. We've had kids who have birthday parties and ask their guests to bring donations for kids at the safe house rather than gifts for themselves, which I just think is amazing. And of course, financial donations. We rely on our donations. We do receive grant funding, but it does not cover all of our expenses. And so that's always a way that you can participate and really help move this effort forward.
Jackie, that sounds like a really good positive note to go out on. So I want to thank you again for taking the time to be here with me today and to give our listeners some really wonderful, helpful information.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for highlighting this very important topic.
That ends another edition of Crossing the Divide. Thanks for tuning in. Remember to follow us on Facebook and now on Instagram at Crossing the Divide to keep up on latest releases and other events. Crossing the Divide is also available on iTunes, Google Play Music, Stitcher, and Spotify. Find us on any of those platforms and hit subscribe to stay plugged in. We're looking forward to bringing you more local voices in 2019. Crossing the Divide, Cultivating Community Through Conversation. This podcast was recorded at KAFM Community Radio.